It's always about thinking about the environment and anticipating what's going to happen next with the environment. And sometimes the environment and impending weather means that we have to treat this like the person's in a house that's on fire, that the best treatment for this person right now is to evacuate them from the immediate threat, which is the environment.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Grange, firefighter paramedic with Jackson Hole, and author of the book Wild Rescues. I'm really excited about today's episode. So this is going to be the first installment of a series I thought of titled Letters to My Younger Self, in which prominent doctors, medical directors, and leaders in the search and rescue, fire, and EMS, and special operations community reflect on what advice they'd give their younger selves just starting out in the profession. So basically, that question of, if I knew then what I know now, how would things change? What advice would I give to myself? Today we have the honor of speaking with John Politis. John is the chief of the Colony EMS Department, a combination career and volunteer service in upstate New York. As an active EMT since 1971, he has been a career firefighter, state EMS training coordinator for two states, Vermont and New York, and a paramedic training program coordinator. He has served as a member of the National Registry of EMTs on their board, as a member of the Committee on Accreditation for the EMS Professions. He is the author of numerous publications, and stays active in the field as a paramedic, ski patroller, EMS and rescue instructor, and volunteer firefighter for the Verdoy Fire District. In the summers, John works with the Jenny Lake Rangers in Grand Teton National Park, conducting dozens of search and rescues by ground and air. John lectures at EMS conferences, both nationally and internationally, and is considered an expert on wilderness medicine, firefighting, search and rescue, and leadership. Welcome to the World Extreme Medicine webinar, John.
Thanks, Kevin. Only correction, I'm the retired chief of the Colony EMS Department. Otherwise, I'd never have time to do all of those things we talked about.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So one piece of advice I got early in my career is someone said to me, have good mentors. Choose your mentors wisely, and not have that mentor mentality. And so I'm really excited to have John on the podcast today because he's been one of my mentors for years. We had the honor of working together at Grand Teton, and John is just someone who I have the highest respect for both professionally and personally. So I'm really excited to have you on the podcast.
Well, thanks a lot, Kevin. It's an honor to continue to work with you. Even though you're not working in the park, we see each other on calls and at the hospital all the time. And it always brings a big smile to my face when I see you. And I love seeing you post stuff on Facebook, what you're doing in the backcountry. And it's a lifestyle that gives us both an awful lot of joy. And you get to live in Jackson Hole year round. I'm just a 5-month resident.
Sure. Great. So I'm always interested in how people find their way into medicine and search and rescue and the outdoors. So maybe you could begin by just telling us, how did you initially get interested in being an EMT?
I'm kind of like that little kid that never grew up. My dad was a volunteer firefighter and worked in a paper mill and fought in World War II. And I used to get on my bicycle and pedal down to the firehouse when my dad was having fire drills every Thursday night. And there was probably never a time in my life where I wasn't completely enamored by fire trucks and ambulances, and for which I suffered a substantial amount of ridicule as a kid because, you know, even when I was in high school and people said, what do you want to do? And I'm like, oh, I want to be a fireman. And but what really got me in the direction of EMS was got on ski patrol because I realized that the guys on the ski patrol got the ski for free and cut the lift line. And I was 15 years old and had to take first aid training. And while I was on the ski patrol, I was going into my senior year in high school. I was encouraged by a couple of my ski patroller mentors to take this new program that was being offered called EMT. And that was in the fall of 1970. And I was only 17 years old, and there really weren't any regulations saying that a 17-year-old couldn't take the training at the time. And I entered the EMT program, and that was really an eye-opening experience. And I also had a bunch of people on ski patrol that were really good mentors. One of them was a man by the name of Ed Augustine, or Augie, and he was almost like a second father to me and took me under his wing. And he was a physical therapist by training. And I was surrounded by people on ski patrol. One was a nurse, an anesthetist, another the physical therapist. And I would sit in the training that we would go through for ski patrol and be just completely on the edge of my seat, learning about things that these people were talking about. And so I entered what was one of the state's first EMT classes, and I finished it on March 20th, 1971, still a senior in high school. And I graduated from high school, and right around that time my dad passed away. He had a form of leukemia that today would have been very treatable, but then it was pretty much a death sentence. And I started college, and my original intention was to be an athletic trainer. And the closest thing you could do in terms of education for that, at least initially, was to major in physical education. So I was a phys ed major in college, which was actually really good because it was really heavily loaded with sciences, anatomy, physiology, and biology, and kinesiology. And I started in the fall of 1971, I started working on an ambulance. And at that time, I worked for a private ambulance company in the city of Albany, which had the contract for emergencies. And I worked with people that were moonlighting, cops and firefighters. And they all pretty much said to me, you know, this is a really interesting thing to do, kid. You know, you'll get a lot out of it, but there's just no future in this. So, you know, finish your college degree, become a teacher, and move on. And it sounds a little bit corny, but myself and I think, you know, millions of others, we watched that the opening TV show for the TV show Emergency. The pilot was on in, I want to say it was either in January or February of 1972. And we all watched that and said, huh, I don't know where this is happening, but I want to go there. I want to be part of that. And what it really showed everybody was that, you know, emergency medicine, as we know it today, was really emerging as an occupation. And I guess from that moment on, I was pretty much smitten. I was also in the volunteer fire department. I was going to a 2-year community college, and I transferred to a college in Vermont. And I went to Castleton State College, which is now the State University of Vermont at Castleton. And became a part-time call firefighter, and I worked for an ambulance service that was run by an undertaker who actually did a very good job of running an ambulance service. And my interest in emergency medical services just grew. I got involved with EMT training that was being run at the hospital. And my first real job was I was hired as a full-time firefighter in Burlington, Vermont, which is about, at the time, was about 100 firefighters and 5 stations. And while I was working there, I had some reputation as a educator, and because I'd done a fair amount of EMT training when I was in college, and the state EMS program was looking to hire a training coordinator for the southern part of the Vermont. So I left the Burlington Fire Department to go to work for Vermont EMS program. I was in charge of the EMS training for southern Vermont, and kind of moved me back to Rutland again. I got back on the Rutland Fire Department, and I just, you know, continued with this. And then in 1980, I accepted a job in Albany, which is where I'm from, to run the paramedic program. And actually, the whole story is I went through the program starting in 1979, graduated in 1980. And when I graduated from the program, they asked me if I'd run the program. So, I had had a lot of advanced training. I was already qualified in ACLS, and you know, could do things like IV therapy and was, in, I guess, would be an advanced EMT by today's standards, you know, with ACLS training. But I hadn't actually gone through a full paramedic program, so I wanted to do that. So, you know, I commuted to Albany, which was home, and went through paramedic program starting in 1979 and finished up in the spring of 1980. And then I was hired to run the program. And the community that I live in, Colony, New York, is a big suburban community of about 100,000 people. At the time, all the EMS was provided by a bunch of volunteer fire department rescue squads. And it was, by the mid-80s, it was failing. And by about 1986, I'd moved on from the paramedic program. I was working in the state health department for New York State Department of Health. And I was in charge of education for New York State. My title was assistant director for EMS education. And the community that I live in, Colony, was looking to consolidate all of their services into a single department. And I threw my hat in the ring thinking, okay, I've done some difficult things before, but this should be pretty easy. And never have I so badly underestimated a job in my life. I worked to consolidate what were those six organizations into a single department. And I worked for three political administrations, two successfully. And in 2010, I retired and moved on. And I've just been working my training and consulting business since then. And in the early 90s, my wife sent me on a climbing trip to the Tetons, and that led to my involvement with the Kenny Lake Rangers. And I've been part of the Kenny Lake Rangers since about 1997. When I was working full time, I would come out to help with training in the spring and then come back to usually work for a few weeks as an emergency hire, usually at the end of the season when a bunch of Rangers were leaving. And then in retirement, my season had just expanded. So in addition to my EMS and fire career, which I've also been in the same volunteer fire department for about 40 years and held every rank in that department up to and including chief. I just stepped down as chief a couple of years ago. I've had a long interest in the outdoors. I've been a hiker and skier and climber. And I've been climbing for a long time. I would say to most anybody that being part of the Kenny Lake Rangers is, and doing rescue in the Tetons is kind of a pinnacle of my career experience because it combines so many different things into one. And you know, because you work there, Kevin, it's an amazing place. And when you combine the amazing place with the amazing people that we all work with, and you know what I mean, because we work with some really remarkable people. And then the really impressive and amazing stuff that we get to do that for most people who work in emergency services, a typical week working in the Tetons would be like people would have the call of a lifetime. But we get to do that almost every day. Sure. Where we're flying in the mountains doing what some people think are just crazy rescues. I don't want to say that they're routine for us because they're not really routine, but the team is such a good team. It's just such a high functioning team that we take things that are really difficult and make them look easy. And that has a lot to do with some folks who are, I know you're going to be on this podcast with you, Will Smith, AJ Wheeler, Scott Gunther, Rennie Jackson before that, Dan Burgett. Now Chris Polino is the district ranger at Kenny Lake. And then the team that we work with, we just work with amazing people. And we, I think, do a good job of combining the application of medicine with really good rescue tactics. And you know, we save people. There's a lot of places where there are no survivors. And, you know, we take people often who are just about at the jaws of death and pull out of the jaws of death because of, you know, fast response and really good application of medical skills. So anyway, that's the arc of my career.
Sure. No, I love it. And yeah, we definitely have what I kind of call this culture of excellence here in the Tetons. And I do think, as you mentioned, it begins at the top with our medical directors, you know, Dr. Will Smith and AJ Wheeler. You know, they're not just signatures at the bottom of a protocol page. They're attending our trainings. We all have their phone numbers. We can call them with a medical question. And they're also out in the field doing rescues themselves. So that's really unique. And we're really fortunate to have them. So yeah, looking back on your career, I mean, it's amazing. Sort of the 70s was the golden age of EMS in the United States, you know, with the first EMTs and first paramedics. And so it's amazing that you were part of that and really an exciting time. And I kind of see now is almost like the second phase of that, now that a lot of medics are starting to, you know, push blood products in the pre-hospital setting. And I know we're getting ultrasound pretty soon here in Jackson Hole. So we're, you know, we're kind of evolving into that critical care medicine, which is exciting as well. And so one other thing I was thinking as you were talking was, to me, EMS and search and rescue, it's almost like a river that people step in and it kind of sweeps you along and takes you where you need to go. And I think your career represents that really well, just since you've had so many varied positions and exciting positions, both as a provider and as a leader. So one thing I really wanted to have you speak on was, unfortunately, within the United States, the job duration for a paramedic is about less than 5 years. People get trained, they work for, you know, 3 to 5 years, and then they move on. But you've managed to work in pre-hospital medicine and the fire service and the search and rescue community for over 50 years. And so I wanted to find out, what's your key to having that kind of longevity? How do you stay inspired and how do you stay healthy?
That's a great question. I think in most things in life, I tend to take the long view. And I don't know that what I'm going to say applies to everybody, but it's just how I've done things. I've always knew that I wanted to be involved in this, and I have availed myself of opportunities that have been varied, and I would say that the job that is the most fun in EMS is being a provider. I think with some important caveats. I think today there are so many places that don't take very good care of their providers in terms of a sustainable and manageable workload, which leads to, you know, work-life balance and so many places that don't compensate people well. I'm really fortunate that, I guess the first thing is, my wife, Ruth, who I met in college, and we've been married for 46 years. We've always worked to live within our means, and, while we could certainly afford a bigger car or a nicer house, there are things we could afford. We have always tried to, I think, live within our means and not get ourselves over our heads financially. And I think when you do that, I think that gives you choices and opportunities to do different things. And from the beginning, I started working as a field provider, but I early on gravitated towards leadership because I wanted to make a change and to improve things in emergency medical services. And I found that in leadership, I was in the best position to be able to do that and to make a change and make things better for people who work in the occupation and also in the lives of our patients. So I've had a long career. I have to say that leadership is not for everyone. And when you step into a leadership position, first as a frontline supervisor, and then maybe as a mid-manager or top-level executive, it comes with a predictable amount of stress. And you shift from, as a field provider, where you get instant gratification, to as a leader, you don't really get instant gratification anymore. That sometimes it can take you 3 or 4 years to see the fruit of your labor. And that requires a long-term view and a different mindset. Throughout my entire career, I've always worked in the field, but I also don't know that I would have survived doing this as long as I have if I hadn't taken other jobs that allowed me to take a break from the daily grind of the field. I think there are many EMS services that have people on a truck, and there's no distribution of workload, and that people are just ground down to a nub because from the day-to-day, going on calls and everything that goes along with that. And I think, you know, one of the challenges that EMS has as a sole occupation in the country is the opportunity for different career paths. And I think that's changing in the country. I think we're getting better at it, but for so many places around the country, the only promotional opportunity is front of the truck or back of the truck. And that there really isn't anything in between, that there are no other career pathways. And I think today that certainly is changing, but I think we have a long ways yet to go. So if you look at the arc of my career, when I get involved in something, I'm not usually a flash in the pan. It's something I do for a long time. I was just recognized as a Johnny Lake Ranger for having 26 years of service. And I posted that plaque on my Facebook page. And I'm really proud of that because I've been dedicated to my team for a long while and the people who are part of it. Whether it's, whatever I've done, I generally commit to it for a long period of time and ride it out. I think there's a lot of people that, particularly in EMS, that chase bright, shiny objects, that always want to go to the next thing. Where is that happening? And I'm going to go there. And I think everybody has to think today about having a long, sustainable career. What can you do for the long haul? And I think there's a lot of people in the occupation that don't look at it from that perspective.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I can attest, having worked with you at Grand Teton, that, you know, you're sort of the first one to raise your hand, obviously for the short haul off the helicopter, but you're also the first one to raise your hand to do that wheeled litter rescue and carry out at 2 a.m. in the middle of the night. So you're always willing, and really appreciate that.
I have. I think I joke that we have the A team and the B team on the Johnny Lake Rangers, but I'm the Z team.
Right.
I'm not the youngest or the fittest, but I'm willing to step up and do any job that needs to be done. And a lot of times that's something that's arduous and not much fun, but I'm willing to step up to do that. And I'm very humbled in the work group that I'm part of that. My job is not that of a climbing ranger. I'm a paramedic ranger, but they fully integrated me in the team. And I, you know, go out and I get to go on a lot of rescues. The other part of that is I think earning the trust and the respect of the people that you work with, because I hope my teammates would say to me that John is a person you can trust and respect, and you know what he's going to do, and he'll be the first to tell you what he can't do.
Sure.
And I also know that a lot of the people that I work with, we're just talking about our friend Lexi, who you saw trail running yesterday. They're young and super fit and can do things much faster than I can. And I don't delude myself into thinking that I can do what they can do, but our team leaders, I think, are pretty smart in putting everybody in a position where they can succeed.
Sure. And I love that idea of speaking up about what you can't do. And I see a lot of young providers who, you know, no matter the patient acuity, they want to be in the back of the ambulance by themselves and thinking that that shows their competence. But to me, the more competent paramedic, and what I do is, hey, if I need extra hands, I'm asking for it, you know,
yeah.
Just to make the call run smoother and to provide that best patient care. As far as your longevity, I really loved what you said about, you know, taking the long view of your career and, promoting into leadership positions, and then also just really looking out for your people, not grinding them down, you know, every day in and day out, but, making them almost like part owners of the agency and of the calls, and, you know, just building them up as well. So, all right. Well, I thought from here we can move into sort of the crux of our podcast. And if you had that chance to give your younger self, or if you some advice, or if you could talk to a young provider who wants to get into fire and EMS and search and rescue, what are a few bullet points you might say to them? What type of letter would you write to your younger self?
Well, I think if you aspire to make a change and to improve your organization, the occupation, whatever it is that you want to do, I think you need to be willing to get involved. And you have to ask yourself a question. And that question is, you know, what do I have to bring to the table, and why am I doing this? And usually it doesn't involve what's in it for you personally. And I think, you know, being a leader is about taking people where they need to go, but not always where they want to go. And I think that's a very difficult thing. But in taking people where they need to go, you also have to take really good care of them along the way. And one of the things that, one of the reasons I got involved in doing leadership development and working with people to improve their frontline supervisory skills is really all about that, because I see so many organizations where if you look forward to coming to work, it's because of the people that you work with, and particularly the boss or the supervisor or officer that you work with. And that's all about taking care of people. There's a big 35-cent word today that people use, which to me is like a red flag, that when people are talking about, well, you need to use this app because it will improve your employee engagement, or, you know, and that's the word, employee engagement. Or if that's a 35-cent word for meaning people actually care about what it is they're doing and care about the organization, that it really is a two-way process, that if you want people to care about the organization, then you need to show that you care about them. And there are huge health systems in this country and other EMS systems that pay people a lot of money as consultants to try and improve employee engagement. And that's a huge red flag that says, you mean to tell me you need to have a consultant tell you that you need to pay attention to and care about your staff and walk your talk and show that? I'm going to mention someone who I know you're thinking about having as a future guest on the podcast, which is Scott Gunther, who Scott is a remarkable leader, and he's a remarkable leader because he actually walks his talk and in many different ways shows and demonstrates every day about how much he cares about his staff. And he takes really good care of them, and sometimes in ways that they don't completely understand. I would tell you, because you know, our locally anyway, our Jenny Lake Ranger team is pretty highly regarded. Well, everybody there is really engaged. And if you ask why are they engaged, it has everything to do with how the team leaders lead the team and show how much they care about people. And in turn, people pay it back in the other direction. They're very engaged. So in the leadership program that I do, really the first day of the program really focuses on really asking people to examine why they want to be in leadership and what they think leadership is really all about. And it really is about taking care of your people, and it's really about influencing people. That if you have to use your power to force people to do things, then you really don't have the ability to influence them anymore. People really should be doing things because they want to do them, not because they have to do them. And I would also say that something that I've had to learn the hard way a bunch of times, that a letter to my former self would be about the importance of humility. And the times that I've managed to get myself jammed up and in trouble and going down the wrong path have had an awful lot to do with a lack of humility and maybe being way too arrogant and self-assured about what it was that I thought we should be doing, and maybe not taking such good care of people along the way. I do have a master's degree, but I often joke that I have a PhD in making mistakes. And there's a lot of things that I certainly wish I could do better and over again. But, you know, at the end of the day, it really is all about people. At the same time, and not to sound like a cynic, but not everybody wants to charge that hill. Like you're thinking about doing an ultrasound program in Jackson, which is a great evolution in our occupation. I'm sure there's a healthy percentage of people who are complaining, why do we have to do that? There's additional training. Are they going to pay me more, et cetera? And it's really the job of leadership to identify what the goals and objectives are and take people there. And when you're changing things, you're taking people out of their comfort zone. There is one more thing, which is a little bit more of a somber thing about note to my former self, that when you are that person who is leading people towards a significant change, whether that be the nature of your service, a new procedure you're going to establish or whatever, everybody does not love you. In that there are some people that are looking for you to fail and sometimes will even turn you into a target. And you have to protect yourself along the way. And probably the best inoculation for the inevitable mistakes that you will make, I think, has everything to do with how you treat people and the goodwill that people have towards you. Because if people are angry at you for some reason, because of change or because of a decision that you have to make, sometimes they'll be angry in the short term, but in the long term, they'll look back and go, okay, that was the right thing to do. And you know what, you know, John or Kevin, they were good guys. They were looking out for us and they were trying to do the right thing. That has an awful lot to do with how you work with people and handle people. On the other hand, if you are a jerk and you don't handle people well, and it's really all about you and you don't listen to people and you don't communicate with people and you treat people right, you become that lightning rod, and you are often perceived as the reason that the organization has problems and are the first one to go. And you know, I'm reminded this all the time that that people tend to react emotionally to things a long time before any logic ever kicks in. And sure. And Ruth says to me all the time, it's all in delivery, and it's often not what you say, but how you say it. And that's a challenge for all of us every day in our lives. And that's a hard earned lesson, I think, for all of us. As a leader, people do expect you to lead from the front. They want you to be in front. They want to have the goal identified, and they want to understand what the process is and where we're going and how we're going to get there and what it means to you. And I've learned the hard way that when you're making significant changes, and I've been a change agent. When I retired from Colony, I became the chief of a community ambulance service, which, you know, we didn't talk about in my resume. And also got convinced to be the chief of my fire department. I've also learned that a lot of times you might be good for a lot of things, but they may not be good for you. That when you step into leadership, it's very stressful. And right now I have to tell you, I'm really happy and really enjoying being a paramedic and a firefighter and not being the chief of something, because it's very stressful, because you not only have to take care of your own personal needs, but you have to place the needs of your staff and the people that are following you often ahead of your needs. And that's exhausting. And it's also stressful. Once you stepped into that leadership role, you in many respects have given up the right to have bad days. We all have bad days, but when you walk in, you're having a bad day and you snap at somebody, it has a whole different meaning when you're the leader. It's not like being a follower. You walk into the station with one of your coworkers and they're grumpy and they're having a bad day, you kind of write it off. But if your boss is having a bad day, it basically changes the whole tone of the shift and the tone of what you're doing in your organization.
Yeah, no, I love it. I've been taking notes as you speak, and some of the things I got from you talking about your career is, you know, if we want change, we have to get involved. always keep that element of humility. It's important to get out of your comfort zone. Just take care of your people. I've seen this at our department. There's small things that can have big morale implications. And, you know, Teton County Search and Rescue, they really take care of their people. And it could even just be a small thing, like they always have energy bars and drinks in the fridge. And certainly Jackson Hole Fire EMS does it as well. But so I would sort of challenge listeners that, you know, within your agency, look for those small things that can have big morale implications, because oftentimes it is the small things that can feel like a lot and make everyone have buy-in. Other things I heard was, you know, in that leadership position, just be able to protect yourself, you know, have some level of an inoculation, which is helpful because at times you're a target, but, you know, taking care of people and listening to people, that's sort of the number one duty. Also lead from the front, and it's not always what you say, that how you say it. And that's kind of what people remember. So I've heard you speak numerous times at conferences and EMS trainings. And one thing that sort of resonated with me was you said, if someone wants to train to be a good leader, they have to first be a good follower. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think there's leadership and, of course, followership. And being a good follower means having a duty of care and loyalty, that you're putting the organization's interests, you know, ahead of your own, and also being loyal to the person who is in a leadership position. And that means, also stepping sometimes out of your comfort zone, and that as a follower, being willing to diplomatically speak truth to power. And I think that is a very tricky thing. I think as a good follower, I work hard at doing what I'm asked to do and doing it to the best of my ability. But I think as a good follower, you're not sitting back criticizing everything that your leader does. And certainly, that's a two-way street. We can be certainly criticized for the things that we do as well. I think a good follower has a relationship, a positive relationship, not necessarily a friendship, but a positive relationship with people that are in leadership, and allowing them to lead and understanding that that a leader can't always tell you everything, and that lots of times there are corrective action things going on behind the scenes. There are budget implications. There are politics, et cetera. And understanding that because you're not leading right now, you don't necessarily understand all of the inner workings and all of the details. And not being that person who sits back and doesn't do anything other than criticize the person who's leading. Now, you may go home to your most trusted confidant. In my case, it's Ruth. Sure. And vent about things, about my frustration. But by the same token, you can't, as be an effective follower, sit there at work and be bashing the people that are in leadership positions. So I think you have to come to work and have a positive mental attitude. And I think another really important part of good followership is you as a follower also, you're leading as well. I think when you come to work and you do your job well, and you're willing to work with others to help train, pass on whatever knowledge that you have, you're also developing and you're demonstrating your leadership ability. There was a fire captain who passed away on 9/11 by the name of Terry Hatton, who was the captain of Rescue One. And his attitude was, I'm not here to judge you, but I'm always here to help you. And he became legendary in his company in Rescue One and FDNY because of his skill, but also that his main purpose was to help the people that he worked with become the best that they could be. and not being there to judge them. And I think as a follower, that's a pretty good mantra, that I'm not here to judge you, but I'm here to help you. We all make mistakes, and none of us is perfect, and we all can learn and become better. I think followership is, there's an art to followership. And one of the things that's very difficult in being a good follower is there are times when your leader is about ready to drive off of a cliff, and you probably, we should all have a relationship good enough that we can say to them, hold on, you're about ready to drive off a cliff. Have you considered this?
Sure.
The hard thing, I think, in the workplace today is that it can become, because some people in leadership are not necessarily secure and sometimes have pretty fragile egos, and it can be very hazardous to speak truth to power. And I think that's where you as a follower need to constantly be being situationally aware and surveying the landscape and understanding exactly what you can say and what you can't say. More than one person I know as a follower has not handled that well, and speaking truth to power has been very dangerous. Certainly has been for me over the years, and it's one of those things that, again, my former self, I wish I had known a little bit more, that obviously we need to lead with honesty and integrity. There are times when you have to be careful not say everything that you're thinking, because sure, it can be really harmful to you. And because I think the first duty you have as a follower is you do need to survive yourself. But in order to be a member of a good team, that means you're there to help support the team. You're not there to undermine it. You're not there to undermine your leader. The best thing you can do is to help develop a strong team is always be there to help your teammates and don't be there to judge them. And step up, do the right thing. Check your equipment, talk about training things, be training constantly. Those are all the things that you can do, I think, to be a good follower. And be there when somebody asks you to do something. I had a captain back in the day that said, congratulations, you're on the Burlington Fire Department. Today you're somebody. Oh, thanks, Captain. He goes, no. When somebody says, hey, would somebody bring the trash out? You're that person. You're somebody. when you whatever it is that, and I also approach my job at Jenny Lake pretty much the same way, that, if something needs to be done, I'm going to step up and do it to the best of my ability. I think, there's an art to followership, just like there's an art to leadership. And I think, as you step into leadership, if you have a little bit of common sense, you realize that it's not how quickly you get the good news, but it's how quickly you get the bad news, and that it is really good to surround yourself with people who are willing to speak with respect but with candor about what is happening and what you need to know. Because when you step into that leadership position, people usually only want to bring you good news, and sometimes you're shielded from things that you really need to know about. And you can't do anything about those things unless you know about them, which means that you have people around you willing to speak with you with a with honesty. That's hard for a lot of leaders to accept that. There are many fragile egos that only want to hear what they want to hear, and effectively, there are problems that are brewing underneath the surface that they can't really deal with because they don't really know anything about them because everybody was afraid to talk to them. Sure. On the other side of that, you can, as a follower, really get yourself put in the crosshairs by speaking truth to power. It may be, it's also known as shooting the messenger, bringing bad news, or bringing bad news in a very unkind and undiplomatic manner, and saying the wrong things at the wrong time. And those, of course, are all things that we would call workplace politics. But being a good follower, it's really all about understanding what the goals are, being willing to do the work, being there to help support the people you work with. Don't be there to judge them, be there to help them. And there you have it. That's the capsulized version of being a good follower.
Sure. Yeah, I love it. I know I've been getting some experience as, you know, being an interim captain on certain days or an officer in charge, and having to lead the crew has actually made me a better follower. And, you know, because I've experienced what the leadership feels like. And, you know, maybe in the past I used to be sort of the good idea fairy who might just throw out all these ideas to my captain. And I learned from being an officer in charge, hey, that's not super helpful. But I love this idea that you mentioned, you know, good leaders lead from the front, but maybe they also have that humility to take that tactical time out and involve the team and say, hey, you guys have any better thoughts? Am I missing anything? So I like that idea of just the leader leads from the front, but he's got that humility that he's not just going to drive off the cliff blindly. He's going to, at some point, you know, seek input from his team. Let's see here. Okay, so kind of winding down on time here. You're definitely a leader or an expert and leader in wilderness medicine. A couple maybe lessons learned from working in the backcountry all these years, whether it's patient care or how to think about a rescue. Any tidbits come to mind? I know you could probably write a great book on it, and I hope you do one day, but what do you got for us?
Well, there's a lot to unpack with that. I think that I all the time I run into people who say, hey, I'd love to do search and rescue. And my first, you know, what I'm thinking about when they say that is, well, how do you feel about suffering?
That, sure.
Search and rescue means usually often rescues don't happen in perfect weather, and it means you having to go out in really bad weather and having to deal with situations. The other part of that, in addition to your personal preparation, your personal fitness, is that particularly in the backcountry, you need to approach the patient, do a very thorough examination so you completely comprehend what the issues are. And to take good notes, obviously, so you can pass that along. But one of the things that is really important is that if we see somebody who's limping down a trail, if we approach that person like we would any other patient who was, you know, next to us, next to the ambulance at the county fair, would usually involve us taking responsibility completely for the situation. And usually that means carrying them. And one of the things that we learned a long time ago is that people have forward motion and they're moving. It's best to let them keep moving, because if not, what's going to happen is that we're then going to be involved in a litter carry or an evacuation, which is going to involve a lot more risk to everyone. And that extends to, we encounter a patient in the backcountry who's turned their ankle, and of course we should do a proper assessment, et cetera. There may be circumstances where if you were close to the ambulance, you might decide to provide some pain management, such as, you know, it could be ketamine or some opiate or opiate derivative. Well, effectively doing that in the backcountry turns that patient into somebody again who has to be carried. So our approach has to be calibrated to what's wrong with the patient, where are they, and how are we going to move them? So there's the medicine, but there's also the evacuation tactics. And the medicine needs to be done in a way which considers the implication to the evacuation tactics. And I think also your strategy and tactics also has to be based upon the situation and the resources that you have. In so many circumstances, I see people who do this want to do things which really get you in deep as a provider. In our situation in the Tetons, it's we're very familiar with the range and how we're going to evacuate people, because we tend to go to the same places a lot. But as you know, I've been on Denali twice, and I was on a West Buttress patrol on 21. I was just working at as a medic at base camp, and I'll tell you, with that, when it's minus 20 you can't evacuate somebody for maybe days at a time, because of the weather and because of where you are, you really have to rethink your entire treatment approach. And for example, in some patients, an IV might make an awful lot of sense, but when you have to take clothing off to start an IV and worry about keeping the bag warm and keeping the tubing from freezing and undressing the patient to be able to get the IV going, it just changes everything. And you have to be really careful about what it is that you're doing, and you have to think through what the clinical course would be and what the consequences of the intervention are going to be. Like, for example, if we have somebody, in a canyon, we have a bunch of canyons that are guarded by big talus fields, and somebody might have a dislocated shoulder. And normally, if you're pretty close to the ambulance, you might decide to dissociate them a little bit or provide some analgesia by using ketamine and then put their shoulder back. On the other hand, if you do that and then think that you're going to walk the person, you've now given them a drug which is going to affect their judgment and their balance. And it's going to be in their system for quite a while, even though the immediate effects may have worn off and it's not safe to walk them anymore. So in some cases, it might mean deciding to maybe reduce a shoulder without providing any type of analgesia because of the evacuation tactics that you have to think about next. And then the other thing about it is, as you know, it's the environment, the environment, the environment, that the environments that we work in, the environment itself is a threat to the person's life, because it's usually, we're in mountains, it's usually colder, or we'll get really cold tonight. And you always have to be thinking about how are we going to protect the person from the environment, whether it's in Alaska and Denali, or whether it's in Garnet Canyon and the Tetons. It's always about thinking about the environment and anticipating what's going to happen next with the environment. And sometimes the environment and impending weather means that we have to treat this like the person's in a house that's on fire, that the best treatment for this person right now is to evacuate them from the immediate threat, which is the environment. I think there are some, there are definitely, and I know Will talks about this, Will Smith, when he talks about wilderness medicine, it's called ideal to real care, in that there's the ideal that you'd like to achieve, but then you have to actually get real to the situation. And every situation involves environment, the evacuation tactics, and deciding what's going to work the best. I could talk for hours about it. I don't want to go off in too much of a tangent, but as you know, I had a climbing accident almost a year ago myself after I got home and was injured, and it was a very bitter pill for me to swallow to have to call for a rescue. But I suffered a major wound in my leg with a compartment syndrome, and it was a high-risk wound because of dirt and sticks and potential for infection. And I had to call for help, and I had to be evacuated by helicopter courtesy of the New York State Forest Rangers and New York State Police Aviation Unit. And on a positive note, I was prepared. I had medical equipment with me. I knew how to access help. I had a Garmin inReach as well as a phone. I had the emergency numbers, and I knew how the system worked. And it was a bitter pill for me to swallow, because that today so many people that go in the outdoors simply want to press a button and get off the ride that they're on right away, and are not willing to deal with the situation and work at self-evacuation. It was difficult for me because in my case, the self-evacuation wasn't possible, and I had to come to grips with that. And I was just lucky enough that there was a weather window, helicopter was available, and they were able to extract me from where I was, and actually had me in, I was in surgery within about 90 minutes of the time of the extraction. They got me to a hospital. So, I'm grateful for a bunch of things. I'm grateful for my wife, Ruth, who took really good care of me. I'm grateful to a rescue system that was in place in functions. It's a highly functioning system. I'm really grateful to the hospital staff. I'm also grateful that I had the communications devices and knew how to use them, and I had the right medical gear to be able to deal with my situation. And the healing process went pretty well. And as you know, I was back rangering again this past summer, and I did another Denali patrol, so I healed up. And but I would say that my leg modeling career is over with.
Sure.
Pretty ugly wound.
Right. Now, did being a patient and kind of experiencing the other side, has that changed any of your thoughts regarding, you know, care, how you handle search and rescue?
It always does. I think I've been a patient a number of times. In the course of my outdoor career, I broke my left leg. I broke my right arm in the outdoors, broke my left leg skiing, broke my right arm a month before 9/11, coming off of a climb, walking on a trail, slipping on a rock and breaking my arm. And then this wound that I sustained, every time, I think being on the other end of the patient care is a very humbling experience. And I would say that in all cases, I got excellent care. Shout out to the Rangers, the DEC Forest Rangers in New York that rescued me, and to the emergency department staff at Adirondack Medical Center, and to my orthopedist here at Ortho New York, and Dr. Smith up in Saranac Lake, and Dr. Quaid, who's my orthopedist down here in Albany. And they knew who I was as a patient because they were climbers and outdoor people themselves, and just much respect to all of them. They treated me really well, and to a friendly face in the emergency department at Adirondack Medical Center, Bruce Berry, who was a paramedic instructor and a longtime EMS leader who was working as an RN in the emergency department. After they had a big smile on their face, "Oh, it's you."
Sure.
They treated me as a member of their family and took great care of me. And in that Ruth, who took care of my every needs pretty much for about 2 months, because I was had a wound vac and my leg up on a, you know, up on a chair, and she had to, you know, bring me food, and, you know, just had to take care of me and to get me to appointments and deal with me. And just can't say enough about Ruth. And we just drove back cross country together from Jackson Hole. We're back in upstate New York now. And so quite an experience being. But the last thing I would say about it is that you know, there is the physical part of being injured, but there's also the emotional part of it. And that you know, it really affects you when you're so used to dancing across rocks and you're so used to stepping on things and not really thinking too much about it. But having an accident then causes you to have a lot of self-doubt about the next move that you're going to make. And it's certainly, if you watch me in the backcountry, I'm always not a long ways behind, but I'm behind everybody going down, and I haven't been for a long time, because the first time I got injured in 2001 with my broken arm, I was descending and slipped on a rock and put my arm out to break my fall and got a Colles fracture of my wrist. And this time I was also descending a slab, and I slipped and, you know, got out of control and fell, and that's how I got injured. So I think there's a whole psychological component of it, which it really works on your mind and creates a lot of self-doubt with you. And takes a while to get your confidence back. And as you know, moving around in the backcountry requires some self-confidence. And without it, you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't ski, you wouldn't climb, you wouldn't hike, you wouldn't do anything, because you'd be so worried about your next move. And it takes a while to get that back. I think at the end of the summer, I've gotten it back. I took my daughter Katie up the Grand, and, you know, I did a lot of climbing this summer. And you know, I'm feeling like my old self again, but I don't forget about what happened.
Right. Well, yeah, I can attest that you got it back, because myself and a friend who is a ICU nurse, we were hiking out in Delta Lake a couple weeks ago, and who came flying in on the helicopter in the short haul but John Politis. So it was fun to run into you in the backcountry.
It sure was, Kevin.
Yeah. Some of the things I loved that you mentioned as far as wilderness medicine is just what you and Dr. Smith talk about, that kind of ideal to real environment, and just looking at the environment, what it's doing now, but also what it's going to do 5 hours from now, 10 hours from now. I also love this idea of you know, we don't often think of, I think evacuation gets not enough press, but when you think of evacuation and extraction, that that is a treatment as important as any of the other treatments. I'm going to teach a avalanche rescue class here, and it's just interesting that we learn, you know, so much of the focus is on the beacon, shovel, and probe, but we never talk about how to get the patient out of there. So I like that you really emphasize the evacuation part. I also loved how in the backcountry, keep it simple. Everything we do has implications. So do they actually need that IV right now? You know, because what we do could, you know, complicate the call. And, you know, us as paramedics, we might want to ramp it up to advanced life support right away and start doing all this stuff. But everything has an implication. So there's always that kind of risk benefit equation we're doing. And then lastly, I love how much you mentioned Ruth, you know, your spouse and wife of 46 years. And one thing we do really well at Jackson Hole Fire Department is we always honor the family, because they are as much a first responder as we are, you know, taking care of the family, taking care of us. So, you know, our partners, our wives and our spouses and our families, you know, they're important. I think kind of getting that longevity that you talk about. Well, I've really, you know, loved talking to you today. And last thing is, you know, I know you teach some great leadership workshops. And if any of our listeners wanted to get in touch with you, either to ask a question about your career or your leadership workshops, how would they best get a hold of you?
I'm on Facebook, and I have two different Facebook accounts. One is just John Politis. The other one is John Politis Educator Consultant. You can just reach out to me at either one of those two formats. I'm pretty busy doing leadership education, and it's called a leadership boot camp, also known as the supervisor's boot camp. And it's really intended for frontline boots on the ground people, both in EMS and fire, to help shorten their learning curve and help them become effective as frontline leaders. And it's all intended to, you know, helping you become the best leader you can be. So you're the kind of leader where people want to come to work and want to work with you. Different formats for the class, but one of the most popular ones is a two-day format. I'm actually going to Maine here the week after next to teach one. And then I've got several of them scheduled around the country. I'll be in Maine, Connecticut, and New Jersey doing programs. And I'll probably have some programs in the West schedule for maybe later in the year that I'm kind of talking to some people now. So, but again, just John Politis, either on Facebook. I'm also reachable on Instagram. I'm just John Politis on Instagram, and can reach out to me that way. And I have an email address, which is also pretty simple. It's johnpolitis@mac.com. It's just johnpolitis@mac.com. Those are great ways to reach out to me. It's a program which, in summary, I've gone through a lot of leadership training myself. A lot of them are great on theory and really short on practical application. And this is really 2 days of class discussion and guided discussion on, you know, the art of being effective as a leader, taking people where they need to go, and not always where they want to go, but where they need to go. And most importantly, taking really good care of people along the way. And also an important component of the class is learning to be careful about how you conduct business and protect yourself. Because in spite of, you can be the best leader around, but, there's always a small percentage of people who want to take your head off, and you need to be somewhat wise and street savvy to, you know, how you conduct business and how you handle people and situations. And so again, it's just it's a leadership boot camp or supervisor's boot camp, and just John Politis on Facebook, and you can reach me that way or email me at johnpolitis@mac.com.
Sounds great. Well, really appreciate you being on the show today, and I already can't wait to re-listen to the episode and take a lot of notes. So thank you for your time. And, you know, we can all hope to have a career as long and as distinguished as yourself. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a million for the opportunity, Kevin. I'll see you in Sun Valley.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot, John.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.